Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn and Mario Ritter. Dan Friedel will tell us what's trending today, and Alice Bryant will bring us this week's education report. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The Trump administration is moving to end a program that protected 800,000 young, undocumented immigrants in the United States. Many of the immigrants were children when they entered the country illegally with their parents. President Donald Trump approved the move, but it was Attorney General Jeff Sessions who announced the change in policy. "We cannot admit everyone who wants to come here," Sessions told reporters on Tuesday. "All cannot be accepted." He added that limiting immigration means we are properly enforcing our laws. The administration is ending a 5-year-old program that former President Barack Obama created through an executive order. The program was known as Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. But the young immigrants also became known as Dreamers. DACA gave the immigrants legal permission to work, study, and serve in the U.S. military. It also prevented them from being sent back to their home country. In a statement, the president said he does not believe it is right to punish the young people for the actions of their parents. But he added, "As I've said before, we will resolve the DACA issue with heart and compassion, but through the lawful, democratic process." Trump accused Obama of going around Congress to put the program in place through executive order. He noted that DACA faces legal tests in several states. He said the Justice Department had advised him the program was unlawful and unconstitutional and not likely to be successfully defended in court. All new DACA applications will be stopped. But officials said people currently in the program will not be affected until March 5, 2018. Existing permits that end before that date can be extended and will be honored for up to 2 years. Trump said the extended wind-down now puts the program's future in the hands of Congress. "I am not going to just cut DACA off, but rather provide a window of opportunity for Congress to finally act," his statement said. Several congressional Republicans had urged the president not to cancel DACA. Paul Ryan, the speaker in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, released a statement on Tuesday. It urged lawmakers to work for a solution for the young people who came to this country through no fault of their own. Ryan said he hoped the House and Senate can find a permanent legislative fix to the problem. He also called for new legislative discussions on border security and other immigration issues. Former President Obama criticized the decision as cruel and self-defeating. Obama defended his approval of the program noting he waited years for Congress to act on immigration reforms, but they did not. Responding in a statement on Facebook, Obama said he believes the Trump administration decision was political and not made for legal reasons. Whatever concerns or complaints Americans may have about immigration in general, we shouldn't threaten the future of this group of young people who are here through no fault of their own, who pose no threat, who are not taking away anything from the rest of us, the statement said. Demonstrators marched in several U.S. cities to protest the decision. In Denver, Colorado, hundreds of teachers and students gathered outside Metro State University. Some carried signs reading, "No borders, no nations, no racists, no deportations." Protests were also held near the White House, outside Trump Tower in New York City, and in downtown Los Angeles. I'm Brian Lynn.
Natural disasters, like earthquakes and powerful storms, can be a threat not only to human life, but to telecommunication systems. When telecommunication networks go down, communities are unable to communicate with each other. But the United States has a system to help Americans get reconnected through wired or wireless technology. It also can provide important information in an emergency. It is called mesh networking. Mesh networks spread connectivity over a number of nodes or connection points that communicate with each other. The first such network was developed for military purposes. Daniela Perdomo is head of GoTenna, a company that specializes in mesh networking. It creates products that use low-frequency radio waves to send text messages and global positioning system information. The company's latest product is the GoTenna Mesh, a mesh networking device that works independently of traditional cell phone networks. Joshua King is lead developer at Commotion Wireless, which creates software products for mesh networks. King said one good reason for mesh networks is that if one connection goes down, others take its place. A mesh network can potentially route around any kind of damage if there is another path for the traffic to go, he noted. If at least one network point is connected to the internet, the signal can be shared. If there is no internet connection, a mesh network can still operate to provide emergency information and basic messaging services like texts. Greta Byram is director of the Resilient Communities Program at the New America Research Center.
The idea is to make telecommunication systems more modular, more distributed, so that even if centralized points fail, you would still have working telecommunications in different areas.
King and Byram attended a recent gathering called SneakerCon at Columbia University in New York City. They and other attendees met to discuss the building of offline networks in local communities.
I think it's important for thinking about the future of utilities and telecommunications, because we're finding more and more that centralized systems just don't make sense.
Byram and others teach communities how to build their own mesh networks with everyday equipment. It's about community control, community power, she said. People start thinking about things like telecommunications sovereignty. Who controls the internet? Who controls what we say online? Who benefits from it? Who gets the data? Daniela Perdomo agrees that people should be more involved in issues of connectivity.
Why can't we empower people to create their own connectivity and create, you know, more of a people-powered bottom-up network as opposed to, you know, a heavy infrastructure top-down network?
North Korea's latest and sixth nuclear test has brought strong reactions from its neighbors and the United States. But Russia and China question additional moves. On Tuesday, South Korea announced that it plans to expand its own missile abilities. South Korea said it has reached an agreement in principle with the United States to increase the payload of its missiles. An agreement reached in 1979 limits the payload and distance of South Korean missiles. The agreement limits South Korean missiles to a payload of 500 kilograms and a distance of 800 kilometers, according to Reuters. U.S. President Donald Trump and South Korean President Moon Jae-in spoke about the change during a 40-minute telephone discussion. In addition, Trump said early Tuesday on Twitter that the U.S. would permit the sale of sophisticated military equipment to Japan and South Korea. At the United Nations, the U.S. has said it will offer a new resolution targeting North Korea. However, Russia and China are questioning whether additional restrictions will improve the situation. After North Korea carried out a long-range missile test in July, the UN placed strong sanctions on the country's economy. Trade bans on North Korea were aimed at cutting North Korean exports by $1 billion. North Korea carried out its latest nuclear test as leaders of major developing countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, gathered in Xiamen, China, a city on the Taiwan Strait. The meeting is known as the BRICS Summit. On Tuesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said at the BRICS meeting, increased sanctions would not help. He said such measures would not cause a change in leadership in North Korea. Putin warned of a global catastrophe if military tensions continue to increase on the Korean Peninsula. Leaders attending the BRICS meeting condemned the nuclear test. But Chinese President Xi Jinping did not mention the incident at the end of the meeting. Later, at a regular briefing, a foreign ministry spokesman called the situation highly sensitive and complicated. He called on both sides to avoid increasing tensions. Bruce Bennett is a defense expert with the RAND Corporation Research Group. He told VOA that the two nations are unwilling to place additional sanctions on the North.
They are reluctant because they just don't know how unstable North Korea is.
Bennett said that China worries about a crisis on its border. He said China may consider the North too unstable to increase sanctions. China has also directed state media to control online discussion of the North's activity, according to Radio Free Asia. The U.S.-based China Digital Times reported that all websites are banned from deliberately hyping related topics. North Korea's nuclear test on September 3rd was its sixth and by far the most powerful. The country said the device was a hydrogen bomb, a more powerful kind of nuclear weapon. The explosion was detected as an earthquake reported to be magnitude 6.3. The test was estimated to equal 100,000 tons of the explosive TNT, or 100 kilotons. On Sunday, a North Korean diplomat attending a UN conference on disarmament in Geneva suggested that North Korea may have another test planned. The official said North Korea is prepared to send more gift packages to the U.S. South Korean media reported that North Korea may be moving a long-range missile into position. And South Korea's defense ministry has warned that the North could launch a missile at any time. Dan Snyder is a visiting scholar with Stanford University's Walter H. Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center. He said it is not hard to understand why North Korea continues its testing activities. He said the North's weapons programs have become too important to the country's leaders to negotiate away for economic gains. I'm Mario Ritter.
This is What's Trending Today. Two recent baby announcements involve famous names. News media reported last Friday that tennis star Serena Williams gave birth to a baby girl. Williams did not provide the child's name to the media. On Monday came news that Britain's Prince William and his wife Catherine are expecting their third child. An official statement said Catherine, the Duchess of Cambridge, is being cared for at Kensington Palace in London. Friday was a big day for the Williams family. Serena's sister Venus Williams was set to play at the United States Open Tennis Championships in New York. At the same time, news came out that Serena had a baby girl. The baby weighed a little more than 3 kilograms. Her father is businessman Alexis Ohanian. Venus told a television reporter about her baby niece just before she played on Friday. Many people used social media to congratulate Serena Williams and wish her a fast recovery. One of them was Williams's coach, Patrick Mouratoglou. He wrote, "I am so happy for you, and I wish you a speedy recovery. We have a lot of work ahead of us." Singer Beyoncé used Instagram to congratulate Serena. Venus Williams won her match on Friday. With the victory, she moved on to the U.S. Open women's quarterfinals. Serena Williams has said she plans to return to tennis in 2018. She last played in January when she won the Australian Open. On Monday, Kensington Palace announced that Catherine was pregnant with her third child. The announcement read, "Their Royal Highnesses, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, are very pleased to announce that the Duchess of Cambridge is expecting their third child. William and Catherine have two children, 4-year-old Prince George and Princess Charlotte, who is 2. The palace also said Catherine is experiencing severe morning sickness. The condition forced her to withdraw from an event she planned to attend Monday afternoon. Morning sickness is when a pregnant woman has nausea and may vomit several times a day. It can be dangerous for the woman since she is at risk of dehydration, but it is not usually a problem for the baby." And that's what's trending today. I'm Dan Friedel.
For VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. If you are standing in front of an iceberg, it might look like the largest thing you've ever seen. But you're still only seeing the small part above the water. About 90% of the iceberg is below the water. This same idea relates to culture, explains Amy Melendez. Melendez teaches English and trains English educators in the Washington, D.C. area. She works at a number of schools, including Northern Virginia Community College and Georgetown University. She says many students and teachers mistakenly think culture is just the things that are easy to see, like food, music, clothing, and holidays. But, she says, most culture is represented in what cannot be seen, people's expectations, beliefs, and values. So she brings lessons about this into the classroom. She teaches learners how to understand and value cultural differences and communicate more effectively with people from other cultures. Like Melendez, Michelle Stabler-Havner is an English educator who has taught intercultural communication. Currently, she is a doctoral candidate at Teachers College at Columbia University in New York City. Both Melendez and Stabler-Havner explain that the subject of cultural understanding is a natural fit in language teaching. They note that language and culture are inseparable. Words and expressions have cultural origins. They also say cultural tolerance helps learners feel safe in the classroom. Stabler-Havner explains.
In other words, they don't have to worry that people are going to criticize who they are or the things that they value most and believe in. This gives students the freedom to focus their energy on learning the language without having to be so concerned that these things that are so important to them are going to be questioned.
Ironically, providing this sense of safety often involves exploring subjects that pull learners out of their comfort zones. One tool both Melendez and Stabler-Havner find especially useful in the classroom is critical incidents. A critical incident is a short description of a situation in which a misunderstanding or conflict took place between people. The problem may be caused by cultural differences or some kind of communication failure. It is the student's job to discover what happened and why. and they are asked to come up with as many reasons as possible other than reasons based on stereotypes. Melendez gives an example of a critical incident she has used from a book called Tips for Teaching Culture.
You have two students who are working on a project, and the student is supposed to be sharing the book with the other student, and it's time for one of the students to leave for class, and the older student who had checked out the book grabs the book, gets up, and leaves because it's time for him to go to his next class. The other student, he's left a little bewildered. Why is he leaving? Why is he taking the book? You know, we were sharing this book. And another part of the incident, too, with that one, the younger student had come late.
Another favorite tool of Melendez is digital storytelling. Digital stories are short movies that combine photos, video, animation, sound, music, and words. Melendez says digital stories encourage healthy conversations around cultural myths. For example, last summer, she trained a group of Panamanian teachers. Through one teacher's digital story, she learned that the person believed Americans were cold, emotionless people. This led to a productive class discussion about cultural differences in how people greet one another and their ideas about personal space.
I think a lot of this intolerance comes from the unknown, so trying to make that unknown known, I think, is really important, even in a language classroom.
As many teachers know, classrooms can be unpredictable. At any given time, a student may say something to accidentally hurt or embarrass another student from a different culture. To lessen this problem, Melendez has her students vote on rules for shared respect, and they are asked to follow these rules throughout the course. Stabler-Havner says students can also practice respect by the way they use the language. For example, they can express possibility by saying, "Maybe this is what is happening," instead of saying, "This is true for every person in this culture." And they can show respect for others' opinions with language like, "I see your point, but," rather than, "As we well know." Before exploring sensitive cultural subjects with a class, Melendez and Stabler-Havner say teachers can spend time examining their own cultural biases. Melendez says uneasy situations or subjects will probably arise in class whether or not English language teachers decide to explore the iceberg of culture. And if a teacher chooses avoidance, they may be left unprepared. She says a website called tolerance.org offers some useful resources for teachers, including web-based trainings. Stabler-Havner says, in addition, teachers can go hear experts speak about intercultural communication. She adds that it is a good idea for teachers to decide before teaching a class whether they will share their own opinions with students about sensitive topics.
Are the students who disagree with you going to feel somehow maybe disempowered or concerned that because they don't share your opinion on a topic that that might affect them in the class?
And that's the Education Report. I'm Alice Bryant.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.